Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The NFL has just announced a new rule today. Players, Seahawks, and otherwise, if you don't want to stand for the national anthem, you can stay in the locker room. But if you're on the field and you're not, quote, standing and showing respect for the flag and the anthem, then your team will be fined. We'd like your reaction to this. We're going to be taking your phone calls, 206-543-5869, 543-5869. That's coming up in a few minutes. First of all, Washington Congressman Rick Larson has broken with his fellow Democrats and yesterday voted for a partial rollback of the Dodd-Frank banking regulations. These are the rules put in place after the Great Recession, meant to help stop the banking abuses that fueled that recession. All of our state's Republicans voted in favor of this partial rollback, but no other Washington Democrat did except Larson, who represents our 2nd District from North King County up to Bellingham and the Sam Wands. Representative Larson, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill.
The Dodd-Frank banking rules were designed to prevent another financial crisis. Why roll back some of those rules?
Yeah, and the existing rules will continue to help prevent the next financial crisis. The reason I voted for this and 32 other Democrats voted for it is that we saw the changes that were being proposed, especially as they impact our local credit unions and local community banks, as a necessary adjustment to the Dodd-Frank legislation.
Your fellow Washington House Democrat, Denny Heck, is on the Financial Services Committee, and he cited some of the same concerns you do. He said local banks and credit unions are struggling under these regulations, and he wanted to support a bill, but here's why he couldn't.
This bill cannot release the pressure small banks are under because it does not address the single biggest cause. And that's the Bank Secrecy Act, CTRs, anti-money laundering. And what is this bill? Not one section, not one sentence, not one word. You know, if my colleagues had been allowed any input, any, I think we could have accomplished the goal. But this bill doesn't solve the problem it aims for and may create new ones.
He's referring there to hurdles that small banks have to go through, forms, rules, disclosures, that he said that's not addressed by the measure you voted for. Why not vote no and negotiate for more?
Yeah, thanks. The first thing is I respect his opinion, and as members of the delegation, we always ask for each other's opinion, but we have to think about our districts as well. And I think, I do know that local community banks and local credit unions that are serving local people in my district would disagree with Denny, and they would disagree respectfully with Denny, that the changes we're making will benefit those local credit unions and local community banks are helpful and helpful to their customers and members.
Is it just small banks getting regulatory relief, though? My understanding is that American Express and State Street and Key Bank, Citizens Bank would be exempted. Is that right?
So you need to go, one can go look at the list of the biggest banks in the country, and one change in this, and I think this is where the large focus is for the folks who critique the vote and critique 2155, is that the top 11 banks in this country all have $250 billion of assets or more, and nothing changes for them. And those are the Goldman Sachs, those are the Bank of America, the J.P. Morgan Chases of the world. Nothing is changing at all for them in terms of extra scrutiny. What the legislation does, though, is move a threshold from $50 billion to $100 billion in assets. But for those folks who are $100 billion to $250 billion, and it might include the banks you've mentioned, those folks will still be subject to the significantly important financial institution rules if regulators determine that they should be. Otherwise, some regs will be relaxed for them. But if they will not, they will continue to be treated as they were before any changes were made.
Well, what
so
about
it's a little bit more flexibility? But that's really honestly that's where most of the criticism is focused on. Meanwhile, you got to measure that with the fact that local credit unions, local community banks, are having to basically act like they're the J.P. Morgan Chases of the world in terms of oversight, and they're not.
Well, here's the reaction from Senator Elizabeth Warren, who used to run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She reminded us on CNN that this is the 10th anniversary of the Great Recession.
This Senate is now advancing a bill that would celebrate that anniversary by saying that 25 of the 40 largest banks in America, these 25 banks together sucked down more than $50 billion in taxpayer bailouts. And this bill says, let's let those 25 banks be regulated just, you know, like they were tiny little community banks.
Now she's talking about the Senate. In the House version, is it true that we'd be regulating big banks as if they were small and harmless?
No, I think that Senator Warren is, kindly overstating her case on this. And in fact, it's just the opposite, that our smaller community banks are being regulated like they are J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. And spending some time with the members of the credit unions and with the local credit unions and the local community banks, they will tell you that with the very actually modest changes that we put in place for them and the customers and the members of credit unions, that it will help them increase their lending. Look, you know, I voted for Dodd-Frank, but if you look at the banks that were listed as too big to fail, those banks have gotten bigger in this country, and we've seen fewer community banks. We've seen mergers and consolidation at the regional and the local level. Meanwhile, the bigger banks continue to get bigger. If there's a legitimate criticism, well, there's probably, you know, I don't want to judge people's criticisms too much, but, you know, we didn't do enough in this bill to add on to regulating the bigger banks, but we certainly, you know, when you look at the really big banks in this country, we certainly didn't diminish the regulatory role for the government over those banks either.
Well, wasn't Washington Mutual, for example, small enough to fit under this partial rollback, and yet that was a big local savings and loan collapse?
Big enough to fail, and it did, for all the right reasons. They got way out in front of their tips of their skis. Banks in Everett, Washington, I don't need to look at Washington Mutual, the friend of the family, as it was called at the time. I can look in downtown Everett at banks that went under because of really poor, I would argue, really poor investment and investment decisions in real estate. And they got caught up more into the real estate as well as the collateral debt obligation problem that came with the real estate loan world. And when you look at the CDO regulation, you know, we passed really tough CDO regulation. That has been implemented by the regulatory agencies, and there's nothing in this bill to roll that back either. And that's what Washington Mutual got wrapped up on the real estate side, as opposed to the investment side.
This is Congressman Rick Larson, a Democrat, represents the Island, San Juan counties, parts of Snohomish, Skagit, Whatcom County. He broke with fellow Democrats yesterday voting to roll back parts of the Dodd-Frank Act. Finally, Congressman, I saw that a federal judge has just ruled that President Trump blocking people on Twitter violates the First Amendment. Have you blocked anyone?
I don't block anyone on Twitter, but we do have a policy, and we let people know on Facebook that if you use certain four-letter words, we will block other people from seeing that. I will see it, but we will not let those folks swear prolifically on my Facebook site because everybody gets to see those comments.
Is your social media team discussing the judge's ruling today?
No, but we're all for it. The president should not be blocking people on Twitter, and we don't block people on Twitter either.
Congressman Rick Larson, Washington State, 2nd District. Thanks for this time.
Yep, thanks a lot.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. You may have heard that the NFL has just changed its rule about what players must do if they're on the field during the national anthem. We'll get into that and take your calls in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. NFL owners have approved a new policy to address the controversy over national anthem protests. Teams, including the Seahawks, will now let players stay in the locker room during the Star Spangled Banner. At least they could let those players stay off the field. But if the players are on the field, they must stand during the anthem or the teams will be fined. Here's what some KUOW listeners have had to say so far.
I'm quite pleased with the fact that the NFL has updated their regulations to reflect their stance on the national anthem. I think it's a good thing that they're supporting players, you know, their right to protest, but in a respectful way. If they want to do it, they can not be there. But if they're going to be there, that show respect.
If the NFL is willing to take a stand to raise awareness for breast cancer and have the players wear pink and they wear ribbons, they should be able to do the same thing with Black Lives. The NFL is largely comprised of African American men. They should be able to speak out about these issues anywhere where racism and bigotry and race pattern health disparities and mortality disparities exist. They should be able to protest those issues. And I feel like this NFL policy is implicitly racist and is trying to silence their voices.
And we want to hear from you right now. What do you think about the NFL's latest solution? Give us a call, 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. The league's commissioner, Roger Goodell, says, "We believe today's decision will keep our focus on the game and the extraordinary athletes who play it and on our fans who enjoy it." So, okay, Seahawks fans, where are you on this? We're taking your calls now, 206-543-5869, 543-5869. My guest is Michael Sean Dugar with the sports journalism website The Athletic. Welcome back, Michael Sean.
Thank you for having me, as always.
You cover the Seahawks and the NFL. Do you think the Commissioner Goodell is right? Today's decision will keep our focus on the game, the athletes, and the fans?
Well, no. Just because, generally speaking, when the commissioner does something that he feels confident is right, he's probably wrong. his touch of what's right and what's wrong is pretty off, right? Just because the NFL's kind of touch of what's right and what's wrong is pretty off.
Why do you think it's off?
Well, I mean, the NFL, people like to. I was just telling somebody this outside that people like to think the NFL or just like sports in general is like a bit like ahead of like society or like more accepting because you see people of different races and backgrounds and whatever coming together for a cause, like it's winning, it's sports or whatever. But really the sports and the NFL in particular is more reflective of like the larger society than we'd like to like acknowledge, in that like the NFL clearly has a problem. Like the NFL doesn't care about women, right? Like we've known that for a while, but we got it like firsthand with like Ray Rice and like some of the other domestic violence things that have happened. Right, like so now we're learning something we've already known, but like it's becoming a little bit more apparent. The NFL doesn't really care about Black people, it doesn't care about their concerns. It's like Kaepernick, one of the concerns he had when he took a knee was, hey, I think it's bad that police who are paid to protect people kill unarmed people and then nothing happens. Like as an idea, as a theory, say it out loud, it doesn't sound that bad, but look at their reaction to it. Right. So, and like, even with this policy, it's clear like the NFL is like, okay, cool. We kind of care, not really, about you guys, but we only care enough to not really like upset the other side. That's a huge problem.
Isn't the league seems to be saying that this is the wrong forum, that when it's a matter of the national anthem and the flag, this is something we're all supposed to be agreeing on before the game begins. We come together as Americans and show respect. You heard one of our listeners say, I think it's great if they want to be in the locker room, they don't want to participate, great, but that's not the time to show disrespect.
Well, and then that's why I like to say sports and the NFL is more reflective of a larger society, right? Because that's an idea we've always heard when it comes to like changing something. It's just like, oh, it's not the time, like it's not the place. This portion of the country isn't ready for this, whether it's, you go back years, it's like, hey, we want to be in the same schools as you guys. Well, I don't think this group would really be ready for that. It's not the time for that right now. It's like, who decides that? It's like, the time for change and doing the right thing is always right now.
Well, let's talk about the specifics of this new rule, again, that players don't have to be on the field anymore, and that's a change.
Right.
But if they're on the field, they've got to, quote, stand and show respect. First of all, how many Seahawks players are we talking about? How many opted to sit or kneel, let's say, last season?
Ooh, put me on the spot. Michael Bennett was obviously at the forefront, and I know Justin Britt stood next to him with his hand on his shoulder. I think Odeyabushi was there as well. Dwayne Brown, when they traded for him, took a knee. And then the entire defensive line would sit with Michael. That felt more like a solidarity with Michael Bennett type thing than it was like individually guys like wanting to protest. And like speaking to the new rule itself, like the new rule is pretty like silly. When you think about it, because it's suppression of speech. Like if you put it frankly, right? It's like, hey, don't do this, or we're coming for you, right? That's why I say they're pretending to care, but not really. Like it's this, they're trying to put it as like this compromise. Like it's not one, because you didn't consult the other side. The other side being the NFLPA, Players Association, who said they weren't consulted. Like the rule,
and they also
said
they're going to fight anything that
right.
goes against their collective bargaining agreement.
Because it's not a compromise if you don't consult the other side. That's the definition of compromise. You need to just figure out what the other side is, then you meet. It's like you didn't even, you know. Probably didn't shoot him a text. So, like the rule on its own that you're going to get fined, we will penalize speech that we deem disrespectful. And then someone today asked Roger Goodell, well, who's going to decide what's respect and what's disrespectful? And it's like, well, the owners.
The owners.
Okay. Well, boom, we have another problem.
Yeah, and the you mentioned a player, a Seahawks player, standing, but with his a hand on Bennett's shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
What if they stand, but they're I don't know, not facing the flag, or their hand is not on their heart, or what? Like, how do you think the owners are going to decide what's a respectful stance?
Well, see, that's the problem. Well, we know kneeling and sitting are be like the main things, but like we've had players who are like they'll be stretching during the anthem, or taping their ankles, or just taping their hands, or anything, right? Like, who gets to determine what's respectful and what's not? Why does this side get that power? That's why I say it's a bigger issue than just like the specific rules of what's going on here, because it goes back to things we've seen before. Like the for the owners to decide what's respectful and what's not is basically to call the protest themselves disrespectful, right? And by doing that, that's disrespectful in itself. It's again dismissive of the concerns of its workforce.
Yeah. Would a raised fist be deemed disrespectful?
Right.
We don't know. We're taking your calls 206-543-5869. 543-5869, and we're talking with Michael Sean Dugar, a journalist at the sports news website The Athletic. And why, from the league's point of view, why do you think the league is doing this?
I can put it frankly the way I've been struggling arguing with people on Twitter all day, like how to bounce around it. It's like it's real simple. The NFL doing this, it's like I said, we don't care about the concerns of our workforce, which is primarily black, if it means offending any portion of our fans or our other, you know, audience that is white. Like, that's why Michael Bennett, when he wrote that book, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable, that's an important title, because a lot of this has just been like a lot of the pushback to anything that's been changed in this country, just generally speaking, has been, it'll make white people feel this way, or it'll make this side feel this way. And I'm breaking it down to black and white because that's been the majority of the discussion for a lot of the time. Like, that's at the core of this, right? It's just like, because the idea of like, yeah, you know, we got people who are like not watching because of the anthem protests. It's always the assumption that they're not watching because, you know, they're like, I don't want to see players protest. And when there's another group out there that's just like, you know what, I won't watch because I don't like how they're treating Kaepernick, or how they're treating Eric Reid, or how people are treating Michael Bennett. Same thing, like if they're going to treat the players like that because, you know, they say Black Lives Matter, well, then I'm not going to watch, right? But the NFL or whoever doesn't want to acknowledge that side, right? Because of what that side generally looks like, right? And that's why I say it's bigger than like we're acting like it is.
And my understanding from a First Amendment professor whose work I read is that this is not, in his opinion, a First Amendment issue, because that business decision, whether we like it or not, is the NFL's right to work out. Whether it violates the players' union agreement is a separate question.
A little different.
This is, again, this would be a fine on a team if a player is not standing and, quote, showing respect. Do we know how much the fine will be? I didn't see any dollar figure.
I didn't see a dollar figure.
Okay. Either.
Probably just slap something on there that feels good. But then again, the PA will probably try to fight that.
That's the Players Association.
Yeah,
Players
Union. NFLPA, yeah.
Could the why fine the whole team instead of players? Do you know?
Well, what they want to do is, I know the NFL has floated some ideas. They want to put like the onus like on the teams, like especially like they have another part of it that's interesting, that the teams can have their own rules.
Yes.
On how to handle that. It's basically we know what it feels like when you put the onus on the team. It's like, hey, it's almost like, hey, get your guys in line.
Could the Seahawks say to players, go ahead and kneel? This is the Seahawks. We'll pay the fine. I mean, could teams have their own setup the country?
You could be willing to do that. But it's I'd like to point out, or not again, but I should point out that the rule today or the policy today was unanimously agreed upon. right?
So the Seahawks signed on.
Yeah, so like for all the for the people like, ah, Seahawks are different. Seattle's different. Like, remember, it was unanimous, right? So, you know, your beloved Pete or John or Paul Allen or Peter McLaughlin, like whoever, right? Like, they can be great people or do good things, and they have, but like, remember, it was unanimous, right? Like, it seems to be a consensus over here how the owners feel about protesting and kneeling for the anthem.
The only official reaction I've seen yet, I haven't looked in a few minutes, was from the Seahawks Twitter feed, and it said, "We all we got, hashtag brotherhood." There's a photo of players standing together. What does that mean to you?
Well, the Seahawks like to push the idea of like unity and like togetherness, which is fine because that's like some of the principles that like football is like advertises itself on. Like, hey, we come together, right? No matter where we're from, whatever, we come together for the sake of like this greater cause, which is really just winning games and winning money. But as you've seen, like the Seahawks' idea of that is a little like off. Like when they locked arms a couple years ago, or like even when they stayed in the locker room week three against Tennessee this last season, like if you got a bunch of guys who are passionate about doing one thing and a bunch of guys who are like passionate about doing another thing and guys who just don't care and you're just like, look, the game starts in an hour, we gotta do something, like then that's not really unity. You guys are just, you know, the clock was ticking.
We have a phone call from Steve in Renton. Steve, thanks for calling. What's your comment or question?
I was just wondering, since the NFL is a private company, why do people think that their personal opinions should or can affect the outcome of this whole debate?
Meaning it's the team should be able, they're running a private business and any employer ought to be able to have a code of conduct? Is that what you're saying? You support the NFL's move?
I would support any sort of move because they're a private company and they can do whatever they please.
How would you feel if do you work for a private company, and how would you feel if you were told to stand for the national anthem at work, on the job?
Why does that matter? I don't work for the NFL.
Yeah, I'm saying if your company, if your private workplace said that's the new rule, that's the new code of conduct, what would you think of that?
What would I think? I'd be pissed.
Why is that?
Because I personally don't want to be told what to do. So yeah. If someone else doesn't like to be told what to do, they could leave. But ultimately, it's a private company. They can do whatever they want.
Right. Any reaction, Michael Sean?
That was a lot. That just threw me off. I think I get that like answer a lot. Like people say like, hey, well, you know, someone tweeted me today and was like, you know, what if the Athletic told you couldn't, you know, do something or something like that? And it's just like, well, yeah, my job doesn't sell me to like for the idea of like selling patriotism, right? Like that's not associated with a lot of our jobs. And like even when it has been like a part of like something we're all familiar with, like making kids stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, we've seen pushback from things like that. Like it's not as simple as like this is a company, they can kind of do what they want. They sell their workforce for like in terms of like as an exchange of like, here, we got a bunch of these guys we can sell patriotism for, shoot us some bread. Like every company ain't doing that. So the NFL is a different animal in that regard. People tend to forget that. Like, there's money tied into patriotism here, which kind of makes you question the legitimacy of the patriotism. But, like,
I think I hear the caller saying, yeah, there's money at stake. You're a private company that has the right to protect millions and billions of dollars if you think that that's the way to do it. And then we can talk about our reaction to that. And we have a reaction from Jennifer in Kenmore. Jennifer, what do you think of the NFL's new rule? You're fined if you're not standing and showing respect at the anthem.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big Seahawks fan. I love the Seahawks. I support them. I feel like the NFL today basically told African-American people and the people who make up most of their football teams that this song means more than the thing that you're protesting. It means more than Black Lives. They have a platform that they should be able to use. And I'm sorry, they aren't just a regular company like this previous person had said. They're the NFL. They have huge representation across the country. And I support these players. And I think that this country should support them as well.
Jennifer, thanks for your call. We're at 206-543-5869. Kurt emailed and said, I'd like to see the discussion be about the real issue, which is how unfairly blacks and minorities are treated in this country. It never gets any coverage why the people are kneeling. Michael Sean, you have talked to many of these players. Why are they kneeling?
Well, it's to protest like racial injustice, you know, systemic oppression, the things that black people have been mad about for a long time. Like, it's not, these aren't new things. That's why I mentioned the segregated schools issue, or, you know, like, we ain't that far removed where we couldn't drink from the same water fountain as white people. Like, you got to remember, this ain't that old, that new of an issue, right? Like, these things are, yeah, Kaepernick said it, like, outright. Like, I think in August of 2016, he said, I'm paraphrasing here, but, like, the police are killing people and getting paid leave. That is wrong. And then he had people act the nerve, like, well, what is he protesting? Guys, he just said it. And it's something that, like, you would think, right, like, ideally, everyone would care about. Like, that's the real, like, if you want to get to the real issue, that's the other part of this. It's like, yeah, the league, like, the NFL has a primarily black, like, workforce, right? The guys on the field are mostly black. But, like, every workforce should care about its citizens' lives, theoretically, right? Like, it shouldn't take a primarily black workforce to care about the police killing people. You know, there's a video of a Milwaukee Bucks player in the NBA being tased by the police, which sounds like unlawfully. There's body cam footage about to come out, you know, come out this week, right? Like, everyone should care about, you know, I don't think I said the color of the Milwaukee Bucks player, right? Because it shouldn't matter. If I did, my bad. But, like, it's because it shouldn't, right? We should all care about a citizen. You should all care, if it's a white guy, it's a black guy, it's a woman, it's a, you know, who. We should all care, right? Because it's still a person at the end of the day.
This is Mike LaShawn Dugar from the sports journalism website The Athletic, and we're talking about the decision by the NFL that it will fine teams if individual players are on the field during the anthem and not standing and, quote, showing respect. Stuart in Interbay, what's your reaction?
What's up, Dwight Sellers? Yeah.
Yes, Stuart.
I really appreciate the passion of the commentator, but I have two words for him: moral relativism. You know, there are so many generalities in the way he's approaching this, but I don't want to talk about that. I guess for me, it's a really simple issue. This is entertainment. The NFL is an entertainment. We're talking about an act that is a one-off, you know, purely symbolic. As I said to you in that little message I left, if players really feel passionately and strongly and committed about this, then that is fantastic, and they should do something constructive with that action. They have the resources. You know, for me, the most powerful thing that I heard with Michael Bennett's experience, and I like Michael Bennett, I respect Michael Bennett, but he was leaving a practice and there were some people protesting and he stopped and he spoke with them and they had a dialogue and the willingness of both sides to talk to each other and hear each other was the most powerful thing. You know, that gave me even more respect for Michael Bennett, because what's happening is people have to listen, not talk to each other.
Yeah. Michael Sean.
I think that's an important part of, like, because there are a lot of people who feel like, I'd miss that guy's name, but there's a lot of people.
Stuart.
A lot of people feel like Stuart feels, right? And I think a specific part in there that I like to address real quick is that, like, yes, they have the platform, they should go, like, do stuff in the community and all that. That's a really disrespectful notion to, like, throw out there, the idea that black people haven't been combating, like, police brutality. Like, we have been. It ain't working. We're trying stuff that'll work. Hear us. Like, that's like, if you think about it that way, like, if you guys, you guys have power, go out in the community, go do this, have been. The idea that we haven't, or that it's like that it's not something that we've thought of, like, oh, gee, man, we never thought about actually going to the community and doing something. No, duh, we've been doing that for a while. And it's gotten to the point where, hey, maybe we should think about, hey, we have been doing that, and it's been so ineffective for decades that now we're going to ways that just piss people off to get attention on the issue.
Yeah, what about Stewart's point? And I've heard that from other fans that's good work that's happening. That's separate. This is Sunday afternoon and Monday night football, and it's time for entertainment, and it's not the place for their opinions.
Yeah, people get killed by the police on Sunday too, and Monday night, like, and every other day of the week. And so, like, there is no escape. It's an escape for you as the viewer. Right, but if Michael Bennett happens to have a taillight out, police, you know, come up, you know, flashing lights. Now he's afraid for his life. Doesn't matter how many sacks he got that day, right? Doesn't matter how much you want to escape from your job that you hate, right? Or you know, like, those things, like, it's a kind of a selfish notion to just dismiss the work that people have been doing to try to combat these things. Like, they are happening. They've been happening. They've also been, I don't want to say completely ineffective, but it's gotten to the point where, like, it's still an issue, one that people are willing to, you know, go to bat for. Like, think about that.
We have time for one more call from Tom in Bellevue. Thanks for calling, Tom.
Hey, I had to wait to get on here and talk to you about this. Let me give you some real quick outline of my career. Infantry, Rangers, 75th Ranger Battalion, Fort Lewis, law enforcement 15 years. I support these young men doing what they're doing, and I'm African American. And we fought for the right for these men to be able to do this. So everybody else that's chiming in, even a president of the United States that hasn't served, don't understand what the scrutiny we as African-American men are going through in this country. And these men are millionaires, and they're making a stand for some of the ones that are lesser economically status than they are. So I really appreciate and respect that, what they're doing.
Tom, thanks for your call. We appreciate you listening and calling in. That's a good segue to Michael Bennett, who we haven't heard from in his own words, who's saying, because the commissioner of the NFL wants respect in the field, and Michael Bennett says when he sat on the bench, he was being respectful and patriotic.
I love the military. My father was in the military. I love hot dogs like any other American. I love football like any other American, but I don't love segregation. I don't love riots. I don't love oppression. I don't love gender slander. And I just want to see people have the equality that they deserve. And I want to be able to use this platform to continuously push the message of that, you know.
That's former Seahawks star Michael Bennett. Final thoughts on this new NFL policy of fining teams when their players on the field and not standing and respecting the anthem, Michael Sean?
I think one thing that I pointed out on Twitter when I read the policy is that, you know, there's the Kaepernick and Eric Reid filed collusion grievances against the NFL, and like
the NFL of keeping them out of the league for their stance.
Mm-hmm. And then you know, Pete Carroll, I think, and John Schneider were both they give depositions, and there's been some across the league. Like, if you think about it, this policy, like, how can the NFL truly be like, hey, you know, we weren't keeping you guys out because of the stance, and then turn around and make a policy that basically explicitly bans what they were doing, right? Like, that's, if someone's like trying to call you out on that, this would be like the almost the number one way to like prove them right in that regard, just like from like a legality standpoint and almost just, you know, common sense. Like this would also seem like a really bad move for the NFL on that part.
We've heard that the Seahawks haven't completely ruled out bringing Colin Kaepernick onto the team, who in a sense started this so-called with his kneeling for the national anthem. Let's pause it there and see what happens and see what Seahawks individual players have to say about this. We've been talking with Michael Sean Dugar of the sports journalism website. He's a writer at The Athletic. Michael Sean, thanks as always.
Always good to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening, calling. Stay tuned to KUOW's The Record. Seattle-based Mars Hill was not your average church. If you walked into a service in Ballard, you might hear a rock concert or a pastor taking post-sermon questions over text message. And here's Mars Hill co-founder Mark Driscoll sharing his thoughts on sex before marriage.
It's the height of arrogance and pride. It's assuming you're the world's greatest, most amazing lover and you need somebody who's ready to do Cirque du Soleil for you.
Mark Driscoll was blunt and culturally relevant. He made Mars Hill one of America's fastest-growing churches until it crumbled in 2014. University of Washington anthropology professor Jessica Johnson explored the fall of Mars Hill Church in her new book, Biblical Porn. I asked her what it was about Driscoll's message that attracted people in the first place.
So the message from the pulpit was one that I think was seductive for a number of reasons, one being that Mark would preach about men taking responsibility for their lives, for themselves, for their families. He would preach that in order to be real men, men needed to get jobs, get wives, have sex at least once a day.
With your wife.
With the wife, of course, within a heterosexual Christian marriage. And also to just take up leadership roles within the family and within the church. I mean, that resonates with a lot of political and economic sort of discourse that we have ongoing now today, right?
Absolutely. Most famously, Jordan Peterson is this Canadian professor, but he's not alone
in
saying this grow up men, be men, take responsibility message.
Right, exactly. And it was also popular with women, too, because as women who perhaps wanted to be married, who wanted to find a good man, Pastor Mark would preach, well, this church is going to produce these kinds of men that can take care of you, that can protect you, that can, you know.
And are good citizens.
And, yes.
And Christians.
Yes, and good Christians as well.
Where does your title, Biblical Porn, come in?
So that comes in because the theology of sex that Pastor Mark would preach would actually be very adamantly against pornographic viewing, right? Telling men that they should not be looking at porn, that if you looked at porn once, you might become addicted to porn. That's a very common sort of understanding within certain evangelical circles. But at the same time, he would sexualize women within sometimes the exact same sermon, talking about women's body parts cloaked in biblical metaphors, right? The Song of Songs is one of the books from the Bible that Mark would often preach from, where this kind of sexualized discourse would come into play. And he would say that in order for women to be good Christian wives, they had to be visually generous and sexually free within the marriage. So if you have already a sort of leadership setup or structure whereby the men are the head and the women are meant to be submissive within the home in general, then you add that to the bedroom and the way that women were supposed to submit to their husbands, whatever their sexual desires may be. And sometimes Mark would step back from this and walk back from it a little bit, but there were times where he would push that.
What would he say? You mean he would preach about dominant and submissive sex? Or are you saying you can fill in the blanks of...
Yeah, it was more of a fill in the blanks. It was more so that, you know, both spouses owned each other's bodies, right? So they were equal in that sense, but they had different roles. And the woman's role was always to be submissive to the man. So even though, you know, there was this kind of equal yet different complementarian discourse, men and women are equal in terms of being both made in God's image, but then different in terms of their gendered roles within the home and outside of the home, then you set up a dynamic whereby it's inevitable that women are still made to feel as though they're supposed to please their husbands no matter what, right? And there was actively preaching about the fact that if women didn't please their husbands, sexually speaking, their husbands would almost inevitably be tempted outside of the marriage. So to keep the men within the marriage, to keep them, you know, their fidelity within marriage, women were supposed to be sexually generous.
Mars Hill Church had some 13,000 congregants. So the message was appealing to somebody. What's an example of a congregant you met for whom this message of the role of men and women and sex, that was giving them something in their life?
Well, I think, again, people who wanted to set up families, you know, people who are younger, looking for a sense of purpose, some stability, looking for a way to, you know, buy into a lot of what we still believe to be the American dream, really, to have the nuclear family set in place, to have the right job, and then to give to the church, right? So it would actually be a mechanism through which then people would serve the church too, because once the families were, you know, Mark would talk about the legacy of Mars Hill continuing on, being multi-generational. Right. And that was a purpose and a sense of cause that was very attractive for a lot of people.
We're talking with University of Washington anthropology professor Jessica Johnson. She writes about the Mars Hill rise and fall of this church and the pastor Mark Driscoll in the book Biblical Porn. So, professor, you did what? You showed up? You got to know congregants? Tell us about that.
Well, what wound up happening was I didn't have permission to talk to anybody within the church without his permission. So that's something that's an institutional regulation that I have to adhere to as an anthropologist, as someone who's doing what they call human subjects review. So I couldn't talk to anybody myself in any sort of informal interview sense. So I would just talk to pastors casually while I was trying to get Driscoll's permission about their doctrine, about their understanding of the gospel, their theology, as well as just congregants, a lot of younger people especially. College-age students were very predominant there. Just to get a sense of where they were at in terms of like what they enjoyed at the church, what they were doing with the church. And a lot of them were just very interested in providing service. That was something that was really hit home.
The Mars Hill Church was once the third fastest growing church in America, 13,000 congregants. But what led to the downfall of the church? Finally, it crumbled in 2014.
So a lot of the leaders basically started getting fed up with this, right? They were being controlled and micromanaged and bullied to the extent that the vision of what the church could be started to become something that was to them quite ugly. Culture of fear was a phrase that was used among a lot of leadership at that time because people were so afraid of seeming divisive, of seeming like gossips, of seeming like the wolves was another phrase that was used in relationship to people who could be seen as dissenters. So because of this culture of fear, a lot of people just finally started to get fed up and say, I have to get out of here. I can't do this anymore. And they might have stuck around because they brought more people into the church. They felt responsible for them, right? So there was a lot of relationship within the church that was still healthy and that people felt responsible for. But at the same time, you know, that couldn't sustain them.
You know, Professor, the church set up an accountability board to look into accusations. The pastor who chaired that board told the Seattle Times, some of what's out there is true, and he's owned it and apologized for it, talking about Pastor Mark Driscoll, and is trying to correct it. And some is not true. If someone went through and dragged out every example, I'm still quoting, every example of where I'd been short with my wife or rude to a coworker or done something stupid and trickled that out week after week after week for months, you'd have no respect for me either. Is that how fair is that?
No, that's not fair at all. I mean, I think after talking to so many people from the years of 2014 to 2016, and then just also by my own personal observation of how insular the culture was there, I mean, people really were afraid to talk out against anything and to be seen as anything other than the good Mars Hill wife or the good Mars Hill husband. So I would say that, you know, from all the stories that I've heard, I mean, the amount of bullying and the amount of abuse and the amount of violence that was perpetrated against both men and women by Mark personally, but that also trickled down and filtered into other leaders just because that's a very corrupt leadership structure, right?
Violence meaning physical violence or psychological violence?
Psychological and spiritual. Spiritual violence. I mean, one, for example, one pastor that I spoke with after everything fell apart told me it was basically when talking about the theology of sex that Mark would preach, called it a theology of rape. It really did damage to a lot of marriages, in addition to the fact that men were just downtrodden. The staff, the men were treated, especially the ones who were on the ground working with people, the people who were actually in pastoral roles that Mark would not take on because he was the figure, he was the one sermonizing, he had, you know, they call it the air war and the ground war. So the guys who are doing the ground war, working with people in community, were actually really just kowtowed to and put down constantly by Mark, such that, again, they felt beholden to the people they were working with and counseling and helping and supporting. But then they had this overseeing kind of bully as their boss, right? And, you know, people would run around with beepers and try to be on beck and call for whatever Mark needed. I mean, some of the pastors later told me, and this is actually in a testimony that's still available online, that there was a kind of a running sort of sad joke where MHPTSD was a phrase that was commonly used among former staff.
MH for Mars Hill.
Right.
PTSD.
Yes. So the trauma that they actually endured, and I would argue some in some cases are probably still processing on some level, was by virtue of working so closely with Mark. So I would say that this is not a common, right? This isn't just your everyday, oh, I'm short with my wife on occasion, or I'm short with coworkers on occasion.
At its heart, Mars Hill was a group of people looking for community. How can any community be immune from a Mark Driscoll-type situation?
Yeah, I don't think you can. I really don't think you can, you know. People ask me whether or not Mark was aware of what he was doing, right? Did he know he was hurting everybody so much? Was he aware of how strategic he was? And I would, you know, I would say sometimes he was and sometimes he wasn't. He talked about, for example, being a riot evangelist. He said in one blog post that some people do relational evangelism. I do riot evangelism. And for him, that meant, you know, in a very Trump-like form, actually fomenting some kind of controversy and then having it go away and fomenting another one, right? So it's like a kind of shock and awe sort of effect where you can't get a handle on the last thing that happened before something else goes wrong or something else comes up. And so people were constantly in a space where they were protecting or trying to defend Mark. And that sort of breeds a sense of loyalty. It breeds a sense of also, I think, desire to feel like, you know, we're protecting our mission, we're protecting our church, we're protecting our community against whoever the other may be, yeah. Right? It could be the media, you know, it could be the feminists, it could be the secularists, it could be, you know, Muslims, it could be, right? There's always this kind of othered threat that was ongoing there. And or again, within the flock itself, right? These wolves that I mentioned earlier, anybody who could be construed as divisive or gossip, right? So it was an inner and outer kind of dynamic. And that's where, you know, the circulation of fear, shame, and paranoia come into play in my work, because I argue that the way that those emotions would circulate was both overt, but then in some ways implicit, right? And they had a certain kind of bodily affect that sometimes people couldn't always make intelligible to themselves.
In 2014, Mark Driscoll wrote to the church a letter that was leaked on Reddit where he said his angry prophet days were over. Where is Mark Driscoll now?
He's in Scottsdale, Arizona. He's preaching at a church called the Trinity Church. And, you know, I've seen some of his sermons. I've seen some of his talks. He has his own website right now, too. So I've caught some of the videos there. He has a new book coming out in October. No need to give him more publicity. He's got plenty of PR behind him. But, you know, I would say that he's definitely taken on this role that he was saying he wanted to take on when at the later days of Mars Hill before it dissolved, the spiritual father role. That is definitely pronounced. I mean, he's older. His wife is with him a lot. He's taken on this sort of like persona of like the family guy even more so than he did previously. So his kids are around a lot. They're participating in some of the church events and blogs and some of the publicity there. So really this guy, this family guy, the spiritual father role is kind of his rebrand, I would say. But having said all that, so maybe his angry young prophet days are over in from the pulpit, but I had somebody within the first day, actually, that the introduction to my book, Biblical Porn, came out. It was being circulated on Twitter. Somebody wrote me and then called me from Scottsdale and basically told me, you should come down here. You should follow up with your work down here because some of the things that were going on in Seattle are still ongoing down here. And that person didn't want me to reveal anything else about their identity because they're afraid. Because they're afraid of losing their community, their family. But basically, you know, the same kind of divisiveness, the same kind of, if you're not loyal to me, right, I want to have nothing to do with you. And if you want me to apologize or listen to what you have to say about what happened in Seattle, I want nothing to do with you. And you are definitely not somebody that is going to be a part of my new church, right? So people have moved and people have picked up their lives and tried to move on. But I would argue that like a lot of these kinds of dynamics are still ongoing in Scottsdale, unfortunately.
Do you think there could be another Mars Hill in the Seattle area?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. I think so. I mean, Seattle's not immune to strains of libertarianism, conservatism. The Pacific Northwest, despite its liberal kind of image, to use that word again, is definitely not immune to any of this. And I think that's what surprised a lot of people, is that something like a church like Mars Hill that was so theologically conservative could flourish in the way that it did. But at the end of the day, again, if you have a certain kind of message that resonates with the national political, economic, cultural situation. I mean, we're in ongoing war. We have been. I mean, a militarized kind of onus to what Mark was doing was definitely prescient. Jordan Peterson's, you know, masculinist kind of ideology is definitely popular here. He sold out his first show in May. I'll be there in June because I got to check it out, you know, because I want to see who's going to these things, right? But they're definitely going. I mean, Seattle is not immune to any of this. And, you know, some of this then bleeds into the tech, you know, industry and some of like, I mean, my next research project, I'm looking into message boards like MGTOW, where guys are talking about not having sex with women or why can't they have sex with women. And it's a very misogynistic, anti-woman kind of community. But I'm certain that there are people who live in Seattle who are part of that community, but it's online, right? So this online, offline violence and the kinds of dynamics and how those play out are really interesting to me. And I mean, it's part of the book in Mars Hill, but I want to take that up further in my next project.
Professor Jessica Johnson, thanks for telling us about this project. The book is Biblical Porn, about the rise and fall of the Mars Hill Church. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Jessica Johnson, University of Washington anthropology professor, and she's going to be talking about her new book, Biblical Porn, at the Elliott Bay Book Company tonight at 7 o'clock. That's our show for today. The Record, produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.